Support for this public radio podcast comes from Vanguard, offering investments designed to help individuals and institutions reach their long-term financial goals. 1-888-VANGUARD.
Good evening and welcome to Talking Volumes. I'm Carrie Miller. It is great to see you all here for the launch of our fall season. Thanks so much for coming tonight. As you know, we begin the new season. It's going to be a terrific one. I cannot think of a better guest to open it with than Sherman Alexie. He's one of the most authentic, outspoken writers on the literary landscape today. He said a while back in an interview, "I always want to be on the edge of offending someone, of challenging one notion or another." He's an undisputed original who once cited his influences in this order: his father, his grandmother, Stephen King, John Steinbeck, and the Brady Bunch. He possesses a notable humility. Asked what he thought of being declared by The New Yorker as the future of American fiction, Alexie shot back, "It's because they needed a brown guy." We're going to talk about all of that tonight. We're also going to talk about what it means that Sherman Alexie's first form of writing was poetry and how that influences his prose today. And he is going to read a poem that has not yet been published tonight, just for us, because we asked. We'll dig deep into the two terrific novels that have come out this year, Flight and The Absolutely True Diary of a Part-Time Indian. So let's get him out here. Please welcome Sherman Alexie. Good to have you here. Thanks very much for coming.
Thank you. It's good to be capital of Indian USA, Minneapolis.
And a lot of young people in the audience tonight to see you. Although, as we know, Absolutely True Diary is autobiographical, I think it's interesting that, as I've read, the book didn't begin in novel form, that it began when you were writing a memoir about your family and your family's history with war. Is that right?
Yeah, I signed a deal 7 years ago to write a family memoir. I'm still working on it. It started off with my grandfather's death in World War II, Okinawa, and a whole story about that. I ended up on Oprah with it. That's a long story we won't tell here, but it's in the book. But I got so obsessed with it. You know, if you ever want to read 450 pages on Japanese sniper rifles, I'm your man. But 400 other pages happened to be my first year at the White High School off my border, where I was the only Indian except for the mascot. You know, I pulled it out because it had nothing to do with war. Not really. It was sort of metaphorical war against expectations and such, but it didn't really fit. Nobody had a gun, and there were no Japanese sniper rifles, so ended up 400 pages sitting on my desk printed out, and a children's book editor called me, as she had called me at least once a year for the last 10 years, to ask me where my young adult novel was. And she called me, and I looked over and I said, "I have it." And so I ended up selling it to a whole different editor.
Yeah, but how do you think you began with this idea of a memoir about your family and their involvement with wars, but you found yourself writing about this year in high school?
Well, the big thing is that it's an immigrant's story. So, which is funny because I'm indigenous. You know, so the irony of being an indigenous immigrant into your own country. So in a sense, you know, when I was doing the work on World War II, I mean, necessarily there were a lot of immigrant tales. A lot of folks fought and joined the military as immigrants to become citizens. So the sense of fighting to belong was really in the war memoir. So my character in this book, Junior, fights to belong on the res, and he also fights to belong in the white community. So that sense of fighting. And especially, as I say in the book, I mean, my res was violent. Fist fighting was very common. There was an established, unwritten set of fisticuff rules. You know, if you know somebody insulted you, you fought them. If somebody insulted your friends or family, you fought them. If somebody was thinking about insulting your friends or family, you fought them. You never fought a girl unless she insulted you, your friends, or your family. And so certainly the violent part fit in.
Is it also true that you decided that this wouldn't be a memoir, it would be a novel, because you've said nobody would really believe this as a memoir?
Oh, man. I mean, it would be so self-aggrandizing. So, you know, Horatio Alger with melanin, you know. you know, the res to riches tale of a boy who grew up with an outhouse and you know, now runs around staying in suites hotels and, you know, making out with movie stars and, you know.
Yeah, but you...
That never happened. I just, you know... I just said that. And then the fact is, that part of it made it feel like I didn't want to turn myself into some mythology. And also, even though it is an epic story, but but the other part is there was so much death that year. In the book, there are 3 deaths.
Right.
In real life, there were 9 my first year at that school. So the violence and the alcoholism and the social problems... And, you know, I was 14, so I couldn't help but think I'd caused it by leaving. And so that strain of tragedy combined with these res to riches, it all seemed too much. And you know, when we look back at our lives, there's always that year or that time frame that's the before and after, the
right.
BC and the AC. And that really is it for me, is that year. Not only did I leave the reservation school in search of something bigger and better, you know, there was so much death and destruction that accompanied it that, you know, me, you know, and my family were forever damaged. And everything I am and do and write really still centers around that year. I think in some way that's why this book is so powerful. It's getting the kind of reviews and attention I haven't gotten in years. So, and I think that's part of it, because it comes out of such a tremendous place of pain, and somehow or another that ends up being very attractive to people. And but I think part of it is there's a serious sense of hope in the midst of all that. And at this particular time, this very intense and violent time in American history, with this particular president and this particular war, I think this book is filling a need. Other books are doing it too. 3 Cups of Tea, I think, is doing that right now, is filling a gap. And so I think I filled a gap that people didn't necessarily know was there.
Do other members of your family see that, perceive that year the way you do, before and after? Do you think some of it was... You were at such an impressionable age.
We've talked about it. We've talked about the book. Although my siblings are just mad because in the book I give the kid only 1 sibling.
That's right.
So my living 2 brothers and 2 sisters are kind of mad at me, right?
I wondered about that.
My big brother wrote me and said, "How come I'm not in the book?" You know, he emails with a res accent. it's a special keyboard we can get. And you know, why aren't we in the book? And I said, because the dead one can't sue me.
So do you think you said you've talked about this? Do they see this line of delineation in their lives the way you do?
Yeah, necessarily. My mother lost her mom and her daughter. My sister within 3 months, and you know, lost her mom to cancer, which is natural causes. I mean, it's uranium mine on my reservation, so natural is debatable. But I just heard the conservative voice in my head say, but uranium's organic. And her daughter, we lost, as I dramatize in the book, fictionalize in the book, my big sister died in a house fire, a trailer house fire in St. Ignatius, Montana, when she and her husband had a party. Everybody got drunk, passed out. Somebody tried to cook on a hot plate and left it on, and a curtain caught the hot plate, and my sister and her husband were too drunk to wake up.
That's all true.
As I dramatize it in the book. So, I mean, my dad's best friend was shot in the face by another friend of theirs who doesn't even remember doing it. They were drunk and fighting over the last drink and a bottle of wine. Uncle died of cirrhosis and aunt died of cirrhosis. So it was like res life concentrated.
Yeah.
And even if we don't necessarily speak of it specifically, the way in which we relate it to the world changed. We hold on to each other tighter, I know. Mm-hmm. We became a closer unit, partly because there's little unit left. The big change was for my mom. You know, I don't want to get into it too much. It's her life, but the biggest change happened to my mom, and we've dealt with that since then.
How did you decide when you knew you'd be using real chapters of your life? How did you decide what was okay to put in and what you weren't going to put in?
Early on in my career, I sort of violated some things, I think. I look back now, and I realize I used specific names of other families, and I shouldn't have been doing that. So I don't repeat those poems. I don't allow them to be republished. Hmm. But that's pretty much the only rule I have. I don't do ceremonies. I don't write about ceremonies at all, partly because it's boring. You know, who really needs to hear about a sweat lodge yet again? I mean, that's one of the things about Native American literature that gets me so angry. You know, when I see it, I'm editing an anthology of Native American literature, and I'm so tired of you know, talking animals. You know, I mean, I expect...
Oh, I see one more. Talking animal.
I mean, yeah. We believe our stereotypes, right? We get so many negative ones, we embrace the positive ones. I know tens of thousands of Indians and have met tens of thousands of others, and I've never met one who talked to an animal and understood anything the animal said back.
How about if we read an excerpt from the novel?
I will read from True Diary, the beginning. I was born with water on the brain. Okay, so that's not exactly true. I was actually born with too much cerebral spinal fluid inside my skull. But cerebral spinal fluid is just a doctor's fancy way of saying brain grease. And brain grease works inside the lobes like car grease works inside an engine. It keeps things running smooth and fast. But weirdo me, I was born with too much grease inside my skull, and it got all thick and muddy and disgusting, and it only mucked up the works. My thinking and breathing and living engine slowed down and flooded. My brain was drowning in grease. But that makes the whole thing sound weirdo and funny, like my brain was a giant French fry. So it seems more serious and poetic and accurate to say, I was born with water on the brain. Okay, so maybe that's not a very serious way to say it either. Maybe the whole thing is weird and funny. But geez, did my mother and father and big sister and grandma and cousins and aunts and uncles think it was funny when the doctors cut open my little skull and sucked out all that extra water with some tiny vacuum? I was only 6 months old, and I was supposed to croak during the surgery. And even if I somehow survived the mini Hoover, I was supposed to suffer serious brain damage during the procedure and live the rest of my life as a vegetable. Broccoli. Well, I obviously survived the surgery. I wouldn't be writing this if I didn't, but I have all sorts of physical problems that are directly the result of my brain damage. First of all, I ended up having 42 teeth. The typical human has 32, right? I had 42. 10 more than usual. 10 more than normal. 10 teeth past human. My teeth got so crowded that I could barely close my mouth. I went to Indian Health Service to get some teeth pulled so I could eat normally, not like some slobbering vulture. But the Indian Health Service funded major dental work only once a year. So I had to have all 10 extra teeth pulled in one day. And what's more, our white dentist believed that Indians only felt half as much pain as white people did. So he only gave us half the Novocaine. What a bastard, huh? Indian Health Service also funded eyeglass purchases only once a year and offered one style, those ugly, thick, black plastic ones. My brain damage left me nearsighted in one eye and farsighted in the other. So my ugly glasses were all lopsided because my eyes were so lopsided. I get headaches because my eyes are like enemies, you know, like they used to be married to each other. And I started wearing glasses when I was 3, so I ran around the res looking like a 3-year-old Indian grandpa. And oh, I was skinny. I'd turn sideways and disappear, but my hands and feet were huge. My feet were a size 11 in third grade. With my big feet and pencil body, I looked like a capital L walking down the road.
Tampa to Tulsa, just one layover and get it over. There's a card game in the backseat. They're throwing dice in the aisle, and the drive just smiles with every passing mile. He's closer to the arms of a woman who loves him. Tampa to Tulsa, one layover. Please don't ask. Stock quotes on a GI's radio. It's given me nothing but false hope. I'm putting it all on the line. Tampa to Tulsa. Please.
you.
That's Tim O'Regan. Tim, thank you. This is great. You're listening to Talking Volumes at the Fitzgerald Theater with Sherman Alexie. I'm Carrie Miller. When we were sitting downstairs and we were listening to Tim play before the show started, you said, I'd give it all up if I could sing and play and have people know the words of the songs that I was writing.
Yeah, I said I think I'd trade my whole big literary career to sell 20,000 copies of my CDs. Yeah.
Why?
Listen, I can't do what they do. I think part of it is, I mean, there's something more primal going on. I think books hook into something very intellectual. I think, you know, the phrase that occurred to me, books work above the waist.
Let's talk about flight. Why not? Let's see what trouble we can get into.
Yeah.
With that,
I'm not sure what we can do with the, you know, the genocidal teenage, you know, murderer novel. I'm not sure we can get any humor out of that. I'll try.
Looking forward to that. The lead character in that novel has a confrontation with his foster family, and he runs away, and he's out on the streets, and Officer Dave shows up, and he and Michael, a.k.a. Zitz, have a good relationship. But Zitz also knows that Officer Dave recognizes something in him, and he says, Officer Dave has never said much about his life, but I can tell he's scarred, and he knows I'm scarred too. The wounded always recognize the wounded. We can smell each other.
That's pretty good. I think it's from my background of addiction and pain and agony that as soon as I meet somebody, in fact, I can almost invariably, when I'm attracted to somebody, you know, as a friend or if I find them, you know, romantically attractive, invariably they've had a horrible childhood. So,
and you sense that on some subconscious level that.
There's something, you know, in our DNA that creates some, you know, unconscious smell, and we know it. I mean, you know, I can tell you there's 112 Indians in the crowd.
It's a magnificent feat.
So,
as I read The Absolutely True Diary, I also wondered if, in some ways, the strong recognize the weak and wounded, too.
Oh, yeah, certainly. Predators,
yeah,
predators.
Right? Bullies.
I was watching Discovery Channel today and at the hotel, and it was that old episode of Lion Pride where a new lion took over and killed all the cubs because they weren't his.
Yes.
And I was watching that going, humans do that, too. You know, I was thinking, we watch these shows because it's us. So, and I was on the radio today, I did an interview, and I made some statements that I've been making because I've become a radical moderate in my politics. And the far left, who used to really love me, now feel disillusioned and betrayed by me. So they've been jumping on me like a pack of rabid wolves. It's amazing how sharp teeth that vegans have. You know.
Flawed fathers. How about that? Let's talk about flawed fathers, because that is a theme that appears in both of these books. Zitz's father has abandoned the family when he was a kid, and he learns why in the book that his father is, as you put it, broken and damaged. And Arnold's dad is an alcoholic who does leave the family, but he comes back and he shows up at the absolute right time. And again, knowing that some of this is autobiographical, I wonder if your father was more like Zitz's father, if he was more like Arnold's father.
Geez, now we're becoming Dr. Phil here. My dad was much more like Junior's dad, much more like the True Diary dad, not the flight dad. My dad was broken and damaged, but he never left for good. He just went on hiatus and sabbatical. It's summer. My father was a college professor without the job. I had a whole riff there. I'm not going on. But my father was an alcoholic, which really, you think about where pain begins, where it started. His dad died on Okinawa in World War II, and then his mom died 6 months later of tuberculosis. Mm. So my father and his sister, my aunt, were war orphans. So the pain started there. I mean, mm-hmm. Your parents die at age six. You really don't recover from that. You only compensate. And so I was raised by a compensator, and he compensated with alcohol. And it's a tragic story, his. When I first started traveling with my books in 93, when my first book came out, people would show up in the audience at the bookstores who saw the name Sherman Alexie in the papers and thought it was my dad. I'm Sherman Alexie Jr.
Huh.
My father was so talented and so amazing in high school, at the Catholic high school he went to in Coeur d'Alene, Idaho, that his former classmates were not surprised at all that he was suddenly having this amazing literary career.
Wow.
So they would come up to me, they would see me in him. Of course, I'm not him, but they would see me in him, and they'd know I was his son, and they'd ask, and they were coming up, and they were athletic directors at universities. They were, corporate lawyers. They were public defenders. They ran sporting goods stores, all of them highly accomplished, and they'd be telling me their story, and they'd say, "What's your father doing?" And randomly employed reservation alcoholic. And the devastation in their faces at the broken dreams, the lost dreams, the loss of promise. So that's what I was raised by.
Mm-hmm.
And in some amazing way, the day I asked my mom and dad if I could leave the res school and go to the white school on the border, my father, probably because he went to a white Catholic high school and really succeeded, and it helped him in all sorts of ways, and despite the fact that it ended up being the last time he was great, let me go. I'm still amazed at it. I mean, we did a family tree in sixth grade. Everybody in the class was related, including the teacher. My mom was born a half mile from where her mom was born. My mom and dad met when she was 14 and he was 5, and she helped him get a drink at a water fountain. So it was a monoculture. I didn't know any white people. The only white people I knew were missionaries who came to the res to save the Indians, or lefty white birdseed eating people who came to the res to save the Indians. And 6 months in, they all talk like us. So it's amazing to me to look back at that epic decision, and it was snap like that. They didn't even pause.
So they didn't talk about it between themselves?
No. I walked up to him. It was that day in school when I saw my mom's name in the math book. Opened up a math book. My mom's name was written in the math book, 30-year-old math book. And I went home, and I said, "I have to leave." And they just asked where. And I said, "Reardon." And then I went into Translucentville. People so white you could see the blue veins running through their skin like rivers. And I sitting here, I'm shocked. It wasn't until I wrote the book and then I actually thought about that moment and tried to fictionalize my parents' response to it.
Do you see it as really courageous?
Incredibly courageous. Mm-hmm. The best possible kind of parenting imaginable.
Really selfless, right?
Yes. They willingly let me betray my tribe. How many tribal members do that? I mean, we're at war because tribal members won't do that. So I love them for it. And for all their mistakes and errors and weaknesses and mortality, that moment, has enabled my life to become what it is, and then to have the influence I have in the Indian world and in the rest of the world. So, you think about how the tiniest possible decisions can change the planet, and they do. I mean, you know, immodestly speaking, I mean, there's never been a me.
How about another excerpt?
Sure.
This time from Flight. And this is where the character has traveled back to really understand his father.
Yes. Who can survive such a revelation when they look into the mirror and discover that they've dropped into the body of their father? It was father love and father shame and father rage that killed Hamlet. Imagine a new act. Imagine that Hamlet, after being poisoned by his own sword, wakes in the body of his father, or worse, inside the body of his incestuous uncle Claudius. What would Hamlet do if he looked into the mirror and saw the face of the man who'd betrayed and murdered his father? And what should I do now that I am looking into the mirror at the face of the man who betrayed and abandoned my mother and me? If I had a sword, I might slide it into my belly and pull upward until I fell dead. But I have no weapon. And what satisfaction is there in killing a man who wants to die? All my life, I've been wanting to see my father, to meet him for the first time. I've wanted to ask him questions, to interrogate him. I stare at his face in the mirror. "Why did you leave me?" I ask. He doesn't answer. "Why do you have a photograph of me when I was 5? Did my mother send it to you? Why do you want to carry a photograph of me, but not me?" I can feel him fighting me. He doesn't want to remember the day he left me, but I am younger and stronger. I am better. I will make him remember. I will force him to remember. I will kill him if I have to. And so I push against my father's mind and soul. I crash through his fortifications and rampage into his memory and tear through his homes, wells, and streets until I see it. The hospital where I was born, or rather, the memory of that hospital. And I burst inside and race up the stairs and back through the years and rush through a door into the maternity ward hallway where my father paces. Somewhere on this floor, my mother is giving birth to me. But my father is not in that room. No, he's outside, removed, remote. "Sir," a nurse asks him, "can I help you?" "My wife is giving birth," he says. "Do you know where?" "Yes, room 812. The nurse is confused. Why is he standing here while his wife is giving birth? Men don't wait outside anymore. Men aren't allowed to wait outside anymore. Or maybe there are problems. Maybe it's a difficult birth. Maybe this poor man needs compassion. "Sir," the nurse says, "your wife and child are going to be okay. We have the finest..." He puts his hand over her mouth. She doesn't stop him. She's too surprised, confused. No father has ever touched her face like that, has violated her boundaries like that. Expectant and fearful fathers have grabbed her, even pushed her, pulled her, but nobody has ever tried to silence her. He realizes his error. He pulls his hand away. I'm sorry, he says. "It's just, I can't stand words right now. I can't stand to hear anybody say anything. Please, just go. Just go and leave me alone." She quickly walks away, wonders briefly if she should call security, but then realizes that the man has enough problems. She knows he's just a weak man, ashamed of his weakness. She prays for him. "Dear God," she thinks, "help this man become a better man than he is now." My father doesn't feel her prayers. He only feels a sharp pain in his chest. Something has broken. He knows he is sick and damaged, but what has made him sick and what has damaged him? My father remembers being 8 years old, lying in bed while a man stands in the dark doorway. Who is this man? It is my father's father. "I know you're awake," my grandfather says. He is drunk, slurs his words, and wavers in the doorway. My father doesn't move. He believes that his father will go away if he doesn't move. It's a magic spell that gets repeated every Friday and Saturday night. "Your mama said you went out shooting today," grandfather says. When my father hunts, he imagines the animals, the targets are his father. Did you bring down anything? Grandfather asks. My father imagines pressing the rifle barrel against my grandfather's temple, imagines pulling the trigger. Did you kill anything, any meat? Grandfather asks. That day, my father shot at and missed 3 quail and 1 deer. I asked you if you got any meat, Grandfather says. My father doesn't want to tell the truth. The truth will get him hurt. A lie will also get him hurt. He's going to get hurt no matter what he does. If you don't answer my question, boy, I'm going to get mad. Silence. I'm going to ask you one more time. Did you shoot anything today? No, my father says. Jesus, what good are you? What kind of man are you? Ain't I taught you how to shoot? And you waste my time and my bullets. You're just a pussy boy. I can't believe you're part of me. I wish you'd just go away. And then my grandfather leaves my father alone in the dark. My father wants to weep. He wants to cry out for his father. He wants to be forgiven, to be loved. But if he speaks, he will only be ridiculed again. He will only be diminished.
You're listening to Talking Volumes on Minnesota Public Radio. I'm Carrie Miller. Sherman Alexie is here with us at the Fitzgerald Theater. Is it true that you read The Grapes of Wrath at age 5?
I wrote The Grapes of Wrath at age 5.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, I mean, I did, and I said it once, but I didn't understand the words. They didn't put that at the back. It says, I read The Grapes of Wrath when I was 5, but I didn't understand all of it. That was the full quote. You know, of course, I haven't corrected it much. But the thing I really identified in reading the book was the poverty, the poverty of the folks. And what really got me, the thing I did understand was the ending, where Rosa Sharon, who's lost her newborn baby, yeah, breastfeeds a starving man. And I understood that, and I connected that so much to the poverty of reservation life.
Why?
You know, as an Indian, you just feel so addicted to charity. You know, everything is handed to you. You know, you're standing in line to get food. You're standing in line to get health care. You're standing in line at school. You're standing in line, standing in line, standing in line. And I also remember the contrast between, you know, watching the news and seeing our great enemy, right, Russia at the time, the USSR, and everybody standing in line to get all the things Indians were standing in line to get. So that sense of starvation, of desperate starvation, and just praying that somebody would come along with that kind of compassion. So I guess reading it, I just kept wondering where Rose of Sharon was, you know, metaphorically, mm-hmm. and real, I guess. So I think in some sense I'm still that way. You know, I'm still looking for Rose of Sharon. That's why I write.
Let me read you something that Steinbeck said about writing, and I'm curious whether you agree with this. He said, the writer must believe that what he is doing is the most important thing in the world, and he must hold to this illusion even when he knows it's not true.
Huh. You know, I've come to believe there are two kinds of writers, the kind who love what they do and the kind who can't stand it. Tim O'Brien, who writes about the Vietnam War writer.
The Things They Carry.
The Things They Carry. He's an incredible writer, one of my very favorites. If you've ever seen him read his work or talk about his work in private, you think he was talking about the most beautiful woman and or man ever. You know, I mean, he's talking about Apollo. His face lights up. I mean, literally, he looks orgasmic when he's reading his own work. I'm looking at him going, he loves his books. I don't understand.
What's wrong with loving what you write?
Nothing. I wish I could. I wish I was Tim O'Brien. I wish I could love my books that way. But I always feel like they're unfinished. I'm always moving on. Everything feels incomplete. I remember the mistakes. I remember the errors. When people look at my books, they see the finished product, but all I see are the Band-Aids. The films I've done, the two films I've done, are even worse in that sense because, you know, it's a much more collaborative, involved process, so you necessarily make compromises. So I see the compromises everywhere, like, oh, I should have fought harder. That's terrible. So it fuels me in a sense. You know, you know, I'm so prolific, I think, because I'm running away from self-loathing.
It's interesting that you say you're always moving on, because I would think, given that, you'd be tempted to go back over it and over it and over it and not be able to release it, because you wouldn't be satisfied that it was finished.
Well, some critics have argued that I have written the same book over and over and over. You know, it's so white guys get obsessions, you know, Indian dude gets repetition. So,
yeah,
you know, it's like Faulkner never moved from about 4 acres, and nobody ever talks about him as being repetitious, even though he is. you know. I mean, Fitzgerald wrote one great book, and he gets a damn theater.
Hey, hold on here.
He gets one.
Hold on. You are in the house of Fitzgerald. Now you're on thin ice,
and just so you know, Scott, yours is always the first book I teach in my American ethnic literature class. It is. I don't think there's any finer Native American book ever than The Great Gatsby. And I'm serious.
It
is the story of Native Americans. So let's just say it's about putting on masks.
Oh, okay.
Like, now like the nine I'm wearing tonight.
Now we have something to discuss.
Yes.
I want to ask you about something that you said about poetry. You said, well, there's certainly a strong narrative drive in my poetry. It was always about the image and about the connection, often a very disparate, contradictory images. Why?
I said
Why?
That?
You did. Isn't that good?
I was smarter then.
You said that you said it in 1998.
When I heard the phrase, what popped into my head was the word borders. As a Native American living on a reservation, growing up on a reservation, I think borders really inform everything I do. Your entire life as the colonized person is informed by that, by borders, mm-hmm. by very strict definitions. So I think I do notice big contrasts that way. I think I'm trained to see in contrasts. I'm not that. This is not me. That's not me. This is not that. Of course, in reality, things are always blurred, but I'm not always so good at seeing the blurs. So I'm working. I'm working hard. I'm you know, I'm a recovery program. You know, I'm in Fundamentalist Anonymous.
Before we hear the poem, your grandmother, your father, John Steinbeck, Stephen King, the Brady Bunch.
Traditional stories, pathological alcoholic lying, the greatest underrated writer in world history, who nobody has ever written better about kids than Stephen King. Nobody. Give me it over Tom Sawyer any day. Tom Sawyer says nothing to me.
Wow.
It speaks to me forever and ever. The Brady Bunch, a sense of timing, a sense of comic timing. I'm a sitcom American. John Steinbeck, paying attention to the poor. Listening to the stories of the poor. So social justice, social consciousness. So to combine all that, I think that's what I do.
Will you read your poem?
Thanks. It's called In the Mood. It'll be in my next collection coming out next year called Thrash. And you talk about disparate images. This is filled with it. Peter Sellers requested that Glenn Miller's In the Mood be played at his funeral. But Sellers hated the song. He'd been a drummer in a pub band, and In the Mood was a common request. How many times must one play a song before one begins to hate it? Does Robert Plant internally weep and wail whenever he hears the first bar of Stairway to Heaven? And speaking of Led Zeppelin, I find it interesting that one of the hardest rock bands of all time also has a song called In the Mood, which is a rather soft love song and could very well be the first power ballad. Hilarious and twisted after his death, Sellers knew that his more casual friends would likely sing along to In the Mood, but that his lovers and best friends would laugh and mock the old tune. It was a strange musical tribute, a posthumous bop, and Sellers' last chance to get a laugh. Thing is, In the Mood is truly a wonderful classic, and Sellers was wrong to hate it, though I suspect he wanted to kill the room with irony. In control from the average beyond, Sellers knew that his request of a joyous, upbeat tune when played at a funeral would cause more grief than a song meant to cause grief. How blessed are the humorous and cruel. But this odd memorial for Sellers also belongs to Glenn Miller, trombonist and big band leader who grew up in Nebraska, started school in Boulder, didn't stay long, then moved to New York instead, and wrote a string of hit tunes. Miller was a commercial success, but his structured songs were often less than respected by jazz critics. In the Mood, however, is a special work of art, one of those songs that best defines an artist and his era. This review of Miller's life is formal, I know, and perhaps too long, but I was trying to write a quiet, murmuring interlude before I called in the horn section and blasted you with Glenn Miller's obituary. On December 15, 1944, while traveling to perform for soldiers in France, Miller was presumed dead when his airplane disappeared somewhere over the English Channel. After years of speculation about the reason for the plane's disappearance, it is now believed that British Royal Air Force pilots accidentally destroyed Miller's plane. Short on fuel after an aborted mission to Germany and struggling to make it back over the channel, the RAF dumped 4,000 pounds of bombs in an effort to lighten their load. One or more of those bombs hit Glenn Miller's airplane and sent it spiraling into the water. When Peter Sellers requested that Glenn Miller's In the Mood be played at his funeral, he likely thought it an odd choice, the last comic gesture. I wonder if Sellers knew Miller's death was unusual, so bitter, funny, and wrong. I doubt it. But now that you've invested so much time in my strange tune, I want you to know I'm full of snakes and rage. I write songs because I've been dispossessed and torn. I'm not in the mood to joke or dance. I'm not graceful or grateful. I'm pissed at God because my father died an early, avoidable death. I'm pissed at God because my father slowly killed himself over the decades. I'm pissed at God because it's easier to blame the Creator than the man who created me. I'm pissed at God because Peter Sellers died an early, avoidable death. I'm pissed at God for being an unreliable narrator. I'm pissed at God because Glenn Miller died an early, avoidable death. I'm pissed at God for being a distant and contradictory deity. I'm pissed at God for unfathering me.
You're lonely and you're lonely.
as everybody's only. Everybody's only.
Tim O'Regan, thank you. Tim, that was just great. Sherman Alexie, thank you. Amazing.
Oh, thank you.
Absolutely amazing. To all of you for coming tonight, thanks so much for being here to help us kick off the new season and patch it on October 16th. Thanks again.
Our thanks to musical guest Tim O'Regan, performing with guitarist Jim Boquist and pianist Peter Schimke. From the Fitzgerald Theater, Tom Campbell, Chris Benson, and Mike Wongan. From the Star Tribune, Sally Williams and Janet Lindblad. From the Loft Literary Center, Claire Wilson and Jared Sentek. From Minnesota Public Radio, Chris Hagel and producer Christine Sweet. Mid-Morning is produced by Chris Dahl, Nancy Liebens, and Susan Leem. We say goodbye today and thanks to Stephanie Souchere, who leaves us for American Radio Works. You can find the whole schedule of Talking Volumes online at minnesotapublicradio.org. As I said, Ann Patchett coming up in mid-October. Walter Mosley comes in November. We just have a great lineup. Be great to see you in the audience. All the information there online, including how to get tickets. Often some tickets, although the tickets are selling well for Ann Patchett, some tickets may be available the night of the show. This is Mid-Morning.